video podcast. I'm your host, Ian Thornton Trump, with my co-host, Tristan D'Souza, head of editorial. Tristan, it's great to be back. I'm really excited. And I guess things are opening up a little bit.
Yeah. It's nice to be out and about with your friends every now and again, isn't it? I mean, as well as the sun being out here, it makes it feel a whole lot more positive. Yeah. And I'm excited about this month's podcast.
And I'm also excited about the fact that we might even be returning to our original podcast location.
Oh, man, fingers crossed.
by next month. So yeah. Everyone, we're super excited. We'll be giving you a complete London vibe. So
yeah, a physical podcast for the first time in 2021.
Exactly. But we decided that we've been talking about this for quite some time of doing a special edition that is focused on one sort of topical area rather than sort of the four or five geopolitical stories that we've been doing in the past. This one is really interesting because it is a global issue. It's about misinformation, disinformation, and outright conspiracy theory, and how sort of destructive this has been to the everything from elections to healthcare. So Tristan, why don't you kick us off with just sort of conceptually what you feel like are the buckets, if you will, of these topics?
Yeah, sure. As you say, this is such a massive issue. It's only got bigger, and it's only going to get worse, I think, as we move into AI and machine learning generated worlds. But that's for later on. The definitions, I suppose, to start with, disinformation, what are we talking about? We're talking about intentionally false material content that has been designed to cause harm, you know. And we're not, as you said, this is a geopolitical issue, but we're not necessarily only talking about political actors, you know. This has been created by all sorts all around the world. So disinformation, intentionally false, provably false content designed to cause harm. Misinformation, though, interestingly, is sort of just misleading, inaccurate content shared by someone who most likely believes it's true, right? So, you know, that indeed disinformation can morph into misinformation quite clearly by those very definitions, right? When, you know, you or I unwittingly shares, I mean, this is unlikely just for our listeners, we're not going to be the ones that do this, but when someone shares you know, some disinformation, it morphs into misinformation. Because if you don't realize something's fake, and as we will, you know, talk about over the course of the podcast, it's becoming increasingly hard to discern the truth of the information that you're reading, even, you know, even if the author seems legit and the publication is legit, the source of their information may have been false. And so, you know, this sort of very, very broad and deep cycle comes into play, which we saw quite significantly with the COVID-19 pandemic, which includes your third category there, outright conspiracy, right? You know, I mean, these are some of you're so hot on this, you know, these are some of the things that you love to bring up and send me stuff at work, like, you know, I mean, anything from that sort of 5G stuff that we saw back in the day, you know, those conspiracy theories, we're smiling, but I mean, they can have serious material real world impact, right?
I completely agree, and I think, you know, I believe that the Rubicon has been crossed, because we have the mainstream media, probably led by the American press, but also European press. We have situations where they are fact-checking the various leaders and the various government officials against their background. But then we see stories about, you know, Rudy Giuliani apparently being warned by the FBI about, you know, Russian agents targeting him. 2 days later, the New York Times, the New York Post, and I think one other publication has to retract the story because it never actually happened. Mm. But the problem is the damage to his character, although, you know, arguing about Rudy Giuliani's character is kind of funny. but let's be fair. I mean, if you continually sort of like imply a bunch of things that aren't true, you're now, you know, assassinating that person's character. And it's interesting to me that we're having a huge, huge problem in our society in combating this. You know, we've seen what happens when a conspiracy theory is coupled with a disinformation campaign, and you have lawyers, officers of the court, going to court with no evidence whatsoever, and then trying to essentially destroy the idea that a company has enlisted Venezuelan money and programmers to change the results of an election by using an automated election machine. And what's crazy about this is the only way to combat it is to sue the individuals in a court for defamation for an extraordinary amount of money. I think the lawsuit being dropped on Rudy Giuliani is to the tune of $1 billion or more. But how long does this take to get through the system, right?
Well, I mean, is that the only way to combat it? You know, it's an interesting thing you say. Like, in this case, yeah, defamation suit is like 100% pretty much the only way to ensure that the truth is out. But, you know, with more generalized disinformation campaigns, which spread mostly through the major social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere, these platforms have moved to take down tens of thousands of offending accounts, which are also offensive, but yeah, of the offending accounts. Mm-hmm. But these keep re-spooling, you know. Yeah. So in terms of defamation suits, that's great. That's one way. But I mean, as you said just now, one of the problems with this is that misinformation can so easily spread to those who might otherwise think they have a fairly well-tuned sense of right and wrong, of sort of, you know, they've got a fairly good radar for bullshit, as it were, you know. And actually, in doing sort of broader reading around this subject for the podcast, there was a wonderful article by a journalist whose name I've forgotten, but he, in the run-up to the Trump election, signed up a random Facebook account of his and linked to all the MAGA sites and all the rest of it, you know, as he was prompted to do so by Facebook. So he signed up all that because he wanted to be on the inside and see what was going on. And whilst he, you know, didn't end up voting for Trump, that wasn't really what he had expected, but what he did see happening to himself over only a matter of days was a transition from an acceptance that there is a truth out there to be had to the universal suspicion of truth as a concept in and of itself, you know. Yeah. Because he would watch the impeachment hearings, for example, on live TV from court, and then he'd sign into his fake Facebook account and read very, very well edited versions of how this was actually tantamount to an exoneration of Trump. And so, you know, if even people like that, you know, journalists who are extremely strict about the information that they're going to pass on to their readers, get sort of uneasy about whether there is even an objective truth, what hope do we have? I mean, this is an extremely downbeat message, but you know, what hope does the regular Joe have, I guess?
Well, yeah, and given that the financial model is all about shocking headlines and advertising revenue derived from ads placed into those articles, you're into a vicious cycle, because the more sensational news that you break, the more money your media empire makes. And we've seen this with Facebook and Twitter being essentially the conduit for mass disinformation campaigns, whether it's, you know, targeting activists in Nepal or Chinese Uyghur positioning of China's view, shall we say, of the world. But interestingly enough, the attempts by social media to police themselves I think is a huge failure. And it's a huge failure because, first of all, they introduced and sort of have resurrected the idea of a verified account.
Yes.
Right? And that a verified account is supposed to be taken as truthful, right? Mm. Which is clearly not the case when a whole bunch of verified accounts get compromised and offered to double your Bitcoin. Pretty embarrassing, to say the least. But the problem is that there seems to be no set standard in terms of what verification is applied to. It seems arbitrary. It seems very biased towards Americans with purpose in the fact that Twitter is an American invention, as is Facebook. So the problem is that if you go to Russia today, it's identified as a state-sponsored media outlet, right? Mm. But no U.S. publications are identified as a state-sponsored publication. So the question is it's completely seems to be biased in two ways. One is it still allows these ridiculous messages to hit the public airwaves, including ad buys by protagonists to cause further dissension among society. But at the same time, the very tools that the social media companies are instituting seem to be creating another set of bias where American values ranging from business to ethics to Christian are foisted upon nations that have a totally different set of cultural milieu and values and society, right? Mm. You know,
And I mean, I suppose also in terms of the verified account thing, that brings up the issue of who the gatekeepers are anyway, right? You know, and in terms of the free transfer of information, the internet is the greatest invention that we've ever seen and, you know, needs to continue to be so. But when you have gatekeepers, you know, let's take Donald Trump's chucking off Twitter and the maintenance of his ban on Facebook, for example, you know, the conferring, as you say, of a blue tick on someone on Twitter is a way of Twitter saying we believe this person to be trustworthy and, well, no, not trustworthy. They just believe them to be a human being, actually. It's really all they're saying. But what we, the public, the users of Twitter, often seem to misunderstand by that is a conferring of trust on that person, when quite clearly it couldn't be any further from the truth. You know, people get, you know, I'm sure Rush Limbaugh has a blue tick, you know, and some of the insane stuff that comes out of his mouth, I wouldn't say was trustworthy, but it is important in the sort of circulating media environment that we hear those things. So, I mean, that is one thing in terms of who the gatekeepers are and why we should trust them to make those decisions, how we understand the decisions themselves. And then if we look at Facebook as well, you know, they've implemented this sort of it's a sort of three questions to help stamp out false news. They were circulating them at some point over the last year, and it was, where's it from? You know, if there's no source, search for one. Like, what's missing? Get the whole story, not just the headline. And then how does it make you feel? People who make false news try to manipulate feelings. And it's like, I feel that really puts the onus, understandably, from Facebook's point of view, because they never want to take responsibility for many of the things that go wrong on their platform. But it puts the onus on the user, on the reader, on the individual, which is legit. You should kind of check something out before you share it. But I think to say, you know, people who make news, who make false news, try to manipulate feelings. I think feelings will be manipulated, as we know, by stories that conform to the biases that we already hold. And that I think is the beauty of misinformation. Actually, you don't have to say very much outlandish stuff to get your stories out there. And as you mentioned earlier on, what happens when these stories are disseminated broadly is that there is an undermining in the faith of the political institutions, you know, and so then people don't really know who to trust. As I was saying with that journalist, if you're not a journalist and you haven't been trained in trying to understand facts, there's a high likelihood that you might start believing this stuff. Actually, I mean, she'll hate me for doing this, but I'll use my mum as an example. Over the course of COVID, she's not a COVID denier or anything, just to be clear, but so she signed up to a medical publication called What the Doctors Don't Tell You. and it's a print magazine. But I think it's pertinent to bring up in the face of this social media stuff. You're smiling because obviously a magazine that says what the doctors don't tell you is quite clearly going to be full of fruitcakes. And yeah. Yet, you know, she was like, actually, no, you know, they sort of, a couple of the things that I've read in there seem fine. And, you know, there was also some herbal stuff and all the rest of it. So it's not all dangerous. But I did a little bit of Googling. And by that, I mean literally one Google search and found a British Medical Journal takedown of the publication because they've published like a story that said autism could be cured with lavender or something stupid. And, you know, all of this stuff. And she was like, oh, thank you so much for checking that for me. I'll cancel my subscription. But, you know, that is just a microcosm of what goes on every day on social media. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we see to bring in, you know, probably as you mentioned earlier, the major state actor, Russia, very skillfully manipulating people's opinions and not through the publication of outright falsehoods. That's the thing. Most of this is very subtly tweaked information, recuts of the impeachment hearings to make it seem like he's being exonerated, and then your biases come in and you share it with your friends. It's a really fertile ground to screw up everyone's trust in politics, since I brought the impeachment in there. And then with COVID, you know, we saw the same 5G, vaccine stuff.
Nanoparticles.
Nanoparticles. And, you know, it's great. The companies are trying to crack down on this. But the techniques that threat actors are using now are moving far beyond just shutting down individual accounts. You know, you see handles being changed from John123 to Jen123. And all of the tweets previously are then impossible to trace for an analyst. You know, even if the account has been archived, you wouldn't know which account to look back on, you know, and all of these accounts are interacting. They're all sharing the same stuff at exactly the same time. So if you're analyzing it, you can show that they're sort of, you know, bot farms pushing this stuff. But, you know, the changing of the guard so quickly means that it's actually rather hard to stop it at source, because perhaps the source changes around as well.
You know, it's interesting because, as you know, one of my things that I like to do is read Department of Justice indictments.
Yeah.
And I was struck by one that I read last week, which talked about the Proud Boys and actually all of the indictment and complaint and all of that legal information was released because one of the members of that particular group was sentenced for 10 years.
Right.
Prison sentence. What I found interesting is it's almost, you know, bordering on the conspiracy theory to suggest that the far right elements of the United States society are getting into bed with Hamas. Okay?
Okay.
So the terrorist organization known as Hamas.
Yeah.
So the connection is that a FBI undercover operator essentially impersonated a member of Hamas to talk to the American far right Proud Boys to create silencers and sears to take semi-automatic weapons and turn them into automatic weapons. So what I found remarkable about this particular story, because if you said that the far right movement of the United States that's supposed to be wrapped in patriotism and wrapped in, you know, a belief of America, and you would think that the natural enemy of that would be a terrorist.
Sure.
Right? Or a member of a terrorist organization.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's like, this is so bizarre, but it is at least as close to the truth as we can get, because literally somebody was sentenced to jail for 10 years for their involvement. And so, you know, I think there is somebody really kind of cerebral that said we're living in a post-truth world. And, you know, it's interesting that we're living in this post-truth world, but we have yet so much surveillance and so much OSINT, so much open source intelligence, that it seems like, you know, we're struggling with a massive information where, like you said, the disinformation, the outright crazy is slipped into this sort of like slipstream, this content canon, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we're left confused. We're left not sure, you know, the idea that Dr. Fauci and the CDC are part of conspiracy theory, you know, and what I found interesting is the mainstream media seems to want to jump onto this. The biggest one being, of course, the Bill and Melinda decision to separate after 27 years of marriage, and mm-hmm. everyone saying that that's the end of the Bill Gates and Melinda Gates Foundation, that mm-hmm. it's done billions of dollars in philanthropic work. Okay, that's not how it works. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a giant trust of money for that organization, and you can't really saw a charitable organization down the middle. Okay, no. And also, if you did, do you not think that the brand that Bill has and that the brand that Melinda Gates has and all of their philanthropic work would be completely tarnished and destroyed if they decided that they were going to, you know, shut down the foundation? It's beyond reason, right? And, you know, this leads us into the whole aspect that I think we're struggling with as a society is as we turn over the truth, we have an adversarial relationship with the truth where mm-hmm. we look for a kernel of untruth or a flaw in the character of the individual to then destroy the entire message, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and we see this time and time again in sort of the mainstream news media coverage of the issues of the day. We're seeing it, you know, in India playing out in real time with the marginalization of the Islamic populations in India. And I think it's incredibly destabilizing to a democracy. To the point that when a country is in crisis, like India, I think that the government and the ability to manage the day-to-day operations of your nation are hard enough without a global pandemic, but are amplified when you have protagonists being able to insert their messaging into a society, especially when there may be an election, which I found very interesting because there wasn't so much any discussion of disinformation around the recent UK elections.
Right? In terms of the by-elections.
Right. But yeah. The headline coming out of the papers was gunboats deployed to the Isle of Jersey because of a fishing dispute that we have with the EU. Gunboats.
Yeah.
Gunboats. These were not gunboats. These were patrol ships. Right. So it's not like they decided to park the Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier off the Isle of Jersey. Okay. And so the rhetoric explodes. You know, it's like anyone that's in the military knows the difference between an armored personnel carrier and a tank. A tank having a very large gun out the front of it. And so when you see in the papers tanks deployed, but they're actually like armored vehicles, slightly, you know, up armored from a Humvee type of thing or a Land Rover with, you know, a screen over the windshield. This is not a tank.
Right.
But the rhetoric being used inflames sensitivities, right? It creates an atmosphere of distrust among authority, and then you have escalations that occur. And we can see this as a clear line from the Capitol, the January 6th protests at the U.S. Capitol.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. So I think the problem is that whilst the problems are myriad, but one of the problems for us sat here on the 7th of May, 2021, knowing what we do about the proliferation of misinformation or poorly reported information, as your story about the gunboats makes very clear, is that People are inclined to believe what they want to believe. Outlets are inclined to be used by opportunist and populist politicians to their own ends. Stories are spread like wildfire across the internet, and there are governments that have, as you said, so many issues to deal with that adding this extra one on top almost seems like the straw that will break the camel's back. And, you know, I do, as I said at the beginning, only see this getting worse because, again, you know, looking around, doing the reading around for this podcast, there was a wonderful article about GPT-3, which is a generative pre-trained transformer, which works by, you know, takes text input and predicting what comes next. It was trained on like Wikipedia and like a ton of, you know, massive data sets. And it's really good. I read, The Guardian published a whole article by it. It's like, you know, grad level standard writing that gets a bit wordy at times, but you're like, okay, great. This is interesting. And that, if it got into the hands, when it gets into the hands of things like people like the Internet Research Agency, or, you know, Iranian government disinformation troops, or indeed the Chinese, will mean that it is almost impossible to discern human and truthfully constructed information from that which has been entirely constructed by machines and with the interests of a particular adversary at heart. And so I think that, you know, I think it is incumbent upon the platforms really to make it easier to flag up poorly, to flag up sort of disinformation and misinformation better, that they, I think, overboard and then have to pull back a little bit, than to have, as you've said, democracy really quite destabilized by the free circulation of information. I mean, you know, Twitter is a sort of melting pot of just really quite divisive rhetoric, as a result also of what you've said, of people immediately looking for the negative. And it's so interesting that I think our public discourse has really flipped in the last sort of 5 to 10 years from a position of acceptance and willingness to debate, at the very least. You know, even if you don't accept the point, you're going to listen to it and then take it, pass it, and regurgitate it with your own views, and a discussion ensues. But then now we're at a stage where everyone says everyone else is wrong, and that's where the discussion stops. And
yeah,
I
completely.
I think that has to be laid at the politicians' doors. They have to change the way they're doing things.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting because if I launch a personal attack on you on Twitter, as an example, platform,
yep.
You can report me and I may get, you know, put in Twitter jail, or, you know, depending on how egregious it is, I might lose my account,
sure.
you know, altogether. But if I share the latest hydrogen peroxide and bleach challenge, which causes harm to people, or my personal favorite was the corn cob challenge, where you try to eat a corn cob that's on the end of a drill.
Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah. So people, you know, are going to hospital with obviously dental damage, possibly broken jaws, things like that. Fun time. Don't use a hammer drill, by the way, kids. I'm kidding. but my point here is that sharing that type of content that is essentially dangerous, mm-hmm. a threat, you know, to life and safety, yet the platforms are like, hey, we're getting a ton of likes on this new viral challenge.
Yeah.
And so you're right. I think there's a need for regulation. I think we really need to understand who's paying for it. I think, you know, some of the greatest law enforcement minds are like, follow the money. This is, you know thy customer. I think, you know, as an example, to buy Bitcoin on an exchange, I have to provide all sorts of personal details and validate who I am and whatnot, because governments have looked at cryptocurrency and gone, oh, by the way, it is a legit thing that we want to tax, so we need to we need to pair you up with your account. One of the problems is again, they didn't anticipate this. So people that made 2 or 3 Bitcoin, or even 20 or 30 Bitcoin at the very early beginning have anonymous wallets. Now we've moved into a state where most of the newly created wallets on the internet are going to be personally identifiable, especially if they're done through an exchange, right? So fair enough, we're solving the problem. But, you know, as an example, in the British High Court system, there was a debate on whether or not Bitcoin was considered a property and whether or not it could be actually seized by the court. So the problem being is that, Tristan, if you have a bank account at a traditional bank, for instance, and I get a court order, I can seize the money in your bank account. But if you have it in Bitcoin, it's in your wallet. I can't seize it from you.
Yeah. And also, I would suggest that the one of the issues with following the money is that in many cases, there's plausible deniability, right? With many of the companies that are being paid for probably directly out of government pockets, whether Russia, China, Iran or North Korean pockets, it doesn't really matter. But these companies, which we know exist and we know have disseminated false information, are just a front, therefore. And if you follow the money, that's where the money stops. You can't get back to the Kremlin or to Beijing. And so, you know, I guess stopping those companies functioning is a step in the right direction. But there has to be some sort of return to an attempt to present objective truth. And that does require responsibility on both sides of the political spectrum, not to be overly partisan. And indeed, you know, as health becomes an increasingly political issue as well, it's everyone's responsibility, I think, to try and look a little deeper into the information that they're sharing.
That's a great place, I think, to call it at this point. So thank you so much for joining us on this video podcast. And of course, you're welcome to subscribe to it.
Please do.
Thanks for joining me, Tristan. I think it was a really interesting look at where we are when it comes to misinformation, disinformation, and outright conspiracy. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Ian.